Welcome to UCCF's Christian Persuaders podcast, a series of interviews with people from around the world gifted and passionate about communicating and defending the Christian gospel. For more information about UCCF, Christian Persuaders, and more episodes from this podcast, do go to uccf.org.uk/Christian-Persuaders. Well, we're going to be talking with Lindsay Brown about creating tension and thirst, in particular in a coffee shop in... Where were we?
Belgrade.
In Belgrade, that's right. But first, Lindsay, many people might know you, but would you like to briefly introduce yourself to our listeners?
Well, I'm a native of Wales. I've been involved in student ministry for over 30 years, first as a student worker in Wales with UCCF, then based in Paris as the European Secretary for IFES and then General Secretary for the International Fellowship of Evangelical Students for 16 years. The last 3 years, however, I wanted to give energy to trying to unearth and develop European university evangelists. So I'm involved in a program with others sponsored by UCCF and IFES with a goal of trying to develop 50 university evangelists across the continent of Europe in the next 6 years.
And as a consequence, you got involved with the mafia in Belgrade, is that right?
In the last few years, we've had a program of inviting folks from the continent of Europe to come and observe UK university missions. And, of course, one of the fresh developments in UCCF has been the development of lunch bars. And we've been trying to work out how this kind of approach would fit within a continental context. So some of the people who came to observe some of these lunch bars in a UK mission were from Serbia, and I asked them if they could work out how to apply this in a Serbian context. Their response was that Serbia was a coffee shop culture, and they didn't think that lunch bars in neutral territory would necessarily work there, but they did believe that in a context where their Christians can't use any university buildings, that the renting of neutral territory, preferably a coffee shop in the centre of a city, might be a culturally appropriate way of engaging with people. So the leaders of the student movement in Serbia did a deal with a large coffee shop in the centre of Belgrade, whereby they promised the owners that they would sell pay for 200 drinks that evening, assuming 100 people would come and have two drinks each, provided they could have use of the exclusive use of the coffee shop for the evening. This they did. It was an experiment, first time they tried it, and then they put on a program for an hour. And the theme of the program, in very relaxed environment, people sitting in easy chairs and having coffee or other soft drinks, was the theme of thirst. And so they invited three of us to contribute, as well as some musicians. I started off by raising five questions with people, or areas where people are searching or thirsty. The thirst for meaning in life. Secondly, the thirst for unconditional love. Thirdly, the thirst for freedom in modern society. Fourthly, the thirst for forgiveness. And fifthly, the thirst or the search for hope. And I did this in a matter of about 12, 15 minutes, usually by touching upon each of these five thirsts with a quotation from contemporary literature and or something from a modern film or a piece of theatre. I didn't provide answers to the five questions that I raised. How can we find thirst? How can our thirst be satisfied in each of these areas? But I did indicate at the end of my contribution that I believe that the Christian worldview provided answers to all five. Then we had musicians sing two songs on the theme of satisfaction, finding satisfying answers to your search or thirst. Then a Bosnian Christian guy who had been involved in leading the mafia in his country before he was converted, now he's a Pentecostal pastor, he got up and he said, "I'd like to share with you how my thirst was satisfied in each of these five areas." And he traced how he had found Christ. Then we had another song or two, and then a third person got up to speak for about 15 minutes, Michael Ott from the UK. And he said, "Now I'm going to share with you an encounter a woman had with Jesus recorded in the New Testament, in which this thirsty woman's search was also satisfied." And he just told the story of the woman of Samaria and reminded people of how they could find answers to these, to their search or their desire or their thirst in these five areas uniquely in the claims of and the person of Jesus Christ over against what the secularistic or other worldviews were offering. The whole program lasted only for an hour, including the music, and each speaker spoke for about 12 to 15 minutes. And then people stayed around afterwards and chatted for about 3 hours until we had to close the coffee shop at 11:30 at night. About 100 people stayed right to the end. And then we, the leader of the evening, invited people to come to a series of three discussion groups that were starting up the following week on the person and claims of Christ. So the coffee shop evening was linked with inviting people to encounter the person of Christ in the text of Scripture in an informal environment where their personal questions could be dealt with around the text of Scripture.
Well, it sounds like a wonderful evening, but some might be thinking, why wouldn't you just jump straight to that passage in John 4 and say, here's Jesus and he's offering living water? What was the point of the songs and the raising the five questions, etc.?
Well, our objective was really to connect with where people are. And one of the ways we believe that you do that is by helping to raise questions with people which they may not even yet be articulating themselves before they come to the meeting. And the roots of our thinking of that really are found in the style of Jesus himself. If you read the Gospels carefully, I've been reading the Gospel of Mark carefully this past year because we've been doing university missions in the UK around the Gospel of Mark. It's intriguing and surprising how many questions Jesus asks in encounters with people. Sometimes even when they ask him a question, he only responds with a question himself. He does that particularly if you look at John's Gospel too, with Nicodemus in John 3, woman of Samaria in John 4, completely different questions. But he does it as a means of opening people up. It was T.S. Eliot who said Jesus was the person who never stopped asking difficult questions. Now, the idea of posing questions to non-Christians in an evangelistic context has become something of a lost art in the way we engage in evangelism. But I believe that often when we pose questions, we both provoke non-Christians to reflect themselves. It challenges their presuppositions. And thirdly, it gives the Holy Spirit an opportunity to lodge a question in people's minds and consciences and gnaw away at it by provoking them to ask, well, would my worldview provide a more satisfying answer to this question than what these people are asking? So the root of it is in the style of Jesus. But I have to say, even in observing some of the best evangelists I've seen the last 20 years, one of the most gifted was Francis Schaeffer, who re-emphasized this lost art of asking questions by talking about engaging in conversation with people and posing questions to people who were very resistant to a straightforward declaration of the gospel. And he talked about the fact that when you do this, actually you take the roof off another person's position. He gave the illustration of everybody's worldview being housed in a building where the windows were closed, where the doors were closed, you couldn't get in, and the only way to access the heart of people in this house, as it were, was to take the roof off and climb in. And he argued that when you're asking questions, you're actually taking the roof off their presuppositions and opening up a fresh way of dialoguing and engaging with people.
Well, let me ask you a couple of questions. Firstly, how do you know which questions to raise and which not to? And then on the back of that, as a speaker, how in practice do you raise those questions, perhaps at the beginning of your talk?
Well, I think some of the questions are age-old questions that people have asked through whole generations. So you find out what the questions people are asking by talking with people, mm-hmm. Engaging with them. You find it out by actually reading newspapers and contemporary articles and watching contemporary films to see the kind of themes that people are touched by. I read the culture section of the Times every Saturday to read the reviews of most of the key new books, mm-hmm. the films and theatre. And I learned this from Schaefer. Okay. 30 years ago, I went to a question-answer session he was leading, and someone said to him, your talks are littered with reference to contemporary theatre and film and music and so on. How do you find time to listen to it all? He said, I don't. I just read the reviews every week. So I've done the same every year for the last 30 years. And this is a way of keeping in contact with our culture. As one Swiss evangelist told me, if you read, for example, even the book reviews of the most prominent thinkers today, you know, and writers of German or English literature, he says the non-Christians are asking the questions better than we are posing the questions, but they often don't have an answer. Mm. Where can you find hope in such a world? Is there an answer to suffering? What about death and so on? And so he said, I use their literature and quotations from their literature to pose the question, because people are reading this kind of material or they're watching it in film, and then I seek to provide a biblical answer. So you start to build a bridge by making a connection with what people are either watching in contemporary film or television mm-hmm. programs or reading in their books. You just read what are the top books in the bestseller list. And you ask yourself, which of those are asking questions?
Okay, just before we move on to the second question, just to move this one forward. So, can you give us an example of a film that you've seen and how you've discerned the key question or questions in it?
Yeah, well, if you don't mind, I'll give an illustration of an older film rather than a more recent, modern one. When he died 2 years ago, Ingmar Bergman, his obituary in the Times and the commentary on his life covered the first three pages of the daily newspaper, page 1, 2, and 3, not the obituary page. But the article on him said, this man is one of the three greatest cinematographers of the whole 20th century because he articulated the human condition. Bergman was brilliant at portraying what life is like in a world where there is no God and where we live in a closed universe. One of his films, which was in black and white and semi-autobiographical, was called Winter Light. Actually, in a university mission I ran a few years ago, we persuaded the film club or the film society in the university to show his film, and then I spoke to it a few days later. Just to illustrate, even though he died a couple of years ago, last summer in London, there was a whole summer series on Bergman's films shown in art centres and culture centres across London. That's how influential he is. Fellini and Antonioni were the other two that the Times indicated were the top cinematographers of the 20th century, by the way. In this semi-autobiographical film, Bergman, whose father was a Lutheran pastor who lost his faith, was influenced by liberalism, but who was a chaplain to the King and Queen of Sweden. In the story you see a parishioner, a man who's lost his wife. He's in despair. He has no hope in the face of suffering and death. So he goes to the local Lutheran pastor or priest and asks him, can you offer me hope in the midst of losing my wife? This Lutheran priest who has lost his own faith says to the man, I can't help you. Then the man goes away and commits suicide. Then at the closure of the film, the Lutheran pastor is agonizing over the fact he wasn't able to help this parishioner. He has a girlfriend. He turns to her and he says, why don't you think I was able to help this man? And then she makes the devastating statement to him that what has intrigued me about you all through the time I've known you is your complete indifference to Jesus Christ. Maybe that's why you couldn't help him. And so Bergman, though he was not a Christian himself, was posing the question of how you find hope in the midst of death in a closed university where he believed there was not a God who was listening, where Christ was not an historical figure who died and risen again, who offered hope. What's the alternative? And his answer was, there isn't any. So you use that film, working off the back of it, and asking, what's your answer? What would you have said in the face of loss? And when you pose the question, you look at different alternatives. You quote Camus, for example, who said, "Atheism is a bitter cup, I've drunk it to the end," and other quotations of great thinkers in the 20th century. And then you say, well, what's the Christian or the biblical worldview in response? And what's your answer?
I think you've probably modelled an answer to my question too about how to raise the question. So you've talked about finding the most articulate and powerful expressions of those questions and then quoting them, pointing people towards them and almost allowing them to speak for themselves. So this is what you were doing in Belgrade. Really, there's those five thirsts. Why did you choose those particular five, and what was your kind of rationale preparing for that talk?
Well, it's based on the observation of what people are looking for in life. If you look at most 20th century philosophers, they have constantly grappled with the issue of meaning. Both postmodernists and before then the existentialists like Sartre and Camus and so on. But they've usually not had much answer to the question of meaning. You see it in literature and art too. Fellini, Francis Bacon, all these guys talked about that man is just flotsam, just riding the oceans of the world without any meaning or purpose. If we deny the existence of a God who created us and to whom we're accountable, so the issue of meaning is there in most of the writings of the serious thinkers in the 20th century. The search for freedom, I think, if anything, defines the Western world. It's the desire for choice and liberty. How can you find real freedom? And I think the Western world is dominated by two concepts of freedom, one which comes from the Enlightenment, freedom with no limits. That's what dominates our culture. But the second comes from the Reformation and from the Scriptures, which is that God has created us as finite beings with freedom within a framework, rather like a fish is free to swim the oceans of the earth but dies when it moves outside that framework. Similarly, we were made for a relationship with God and die if we move outside that relationship. So freedom and choice is a defining cry, if you like. How can I find that in the world in which we live? Then thirdly, love, the search for love. Well, it's obvious with all the rom-coms and the books on love and romance that everybody is searching for intimacy, and that's really what drives the whole sexual revolution. It's not just so you can have sex with as many people as possible, but ultimately deep down what most people are looking for is an intimate relationship with someone which is long-lasting. And sex is seen as partly as a gateway to that. So the search for unconditional love and intimacy is a longing of the human heart. Fourthly, not many people ask questions about how can I find forgiveness, but you've got to raise that question because it's at the heart of the gospel, so you've got to insert that even if they're not raising the question. Sometimes you have to raise a question even if people are not raising it. And fifthly, hope. Well, everybody's looking for sort of hope in a desperate world, whether it's related to employment or relationships or the future for their family, but hope beyond death also in the midst of loss and grief, which we all face at some point in our lives. So I think those are five big questions which at different points in their lives people ask, and it's important to pose them when people are young so they begin grappling with them. And I think that the Bible has substantial answers to them all.
So we've been talking about raising questions and the importance of doing so, building tension in this context, creating a thirst for the truth. And I'm conscious that you're probably needing a drink and your voice is getting drier and drier. So we'll bring this to a close. If there are any resources available to all that you would recommend, apart from the Times Cultural Guide on Saturday, what would those be?
Well, I think the UCCF website, Be Thinking, is one of the best available, because there, those who do excellent work in putting the material together on the website are, on the one hand, trying to answer questions which non-Christians are asking in contemporary society, and on the other hand, are seeking to equip and strengthen the sense of confidence and conviction in the truth claims of the gospel amongst believers. So I would certainly access that material. There's also a very good new book written by Jerome Bars, B-A-R-R-S, who used to work in Labrie with Schaefer, which is a book on evangelism, Jesus style, and in it he articulates, by a careful analysis of the gospel, how Jesus was a master question asker. So if you want further verification of Jesus' style, which included not just front-on communication, direct speech, but was often prepared by the posing of questions to people, and different questions to different people, depending on where you perceive they were coming from. I think that's a wonderful book on evangelism, probably one of the three best books on evangelism I have read, together with Michael Green's Evangelism in the Early Church and Becky Pippert's Out of the Salt Shaker, which have different emphases. Those books, I think, are helpful. Michael Green's book, Evangelism in the Early Church, is the best failed doctrinal thesis I've ever read. He never got a doctorate for it, but it is a brilliant assessment of how the gospel spread and how the early apostles communicated the gospel, both creatively, seeking to get under the skin of the culture, engaging with people. And what is masterful is also Michael has a background not just in theology but in classics. He had a double first in classics and theology. So you'll find material in there you wouldn't find in the books of many other evangelists. It is full of references to classical literature, particularly Roman and Greek historians, and some of them writing at the time of Jesus, Josephus too, the Jewish historian. And there's a lot that we can learn from the writings of some of these people. So those are good books. When I was a student myself, and just after, I set myself the goal in 1 year of ascertaining what are the top 12 questions people ask. And I decided I would try to formulate an answer to each of those questions, one a month, for the first year after I left university. Those are questions like, why does the God of love allow suffering? Is conversion psychological? In what sense is Jesus unique? Does the Christian faith crush liberty or enhance it? Those kind of things. And I asked an older man if he would guide my reading and lead me to tapes, which is all we had in those days, cassette tapes and books. And based on the material he suggested, I wrote an answer to each of those top 12 questions. And actually, I still use a lot of that material today as a framework for answering people's questions. Excuse me, there are some good books published by IVP and others. Paul Weston, Michael Ott's, Michael Green have tried to, in their evangelistic books, respond to the top questions that people have. I still think that three of the best series of evangelistic addresses I have ever seen are in the books written by David Watson, which, even though they were 30 years ago and many of the illustrations are out of date, the framework for answering the questions was excellent. And those books are entitled In Search of God, My God is Real, and Is Anyone There? And actually, I still read through those books every year before I do a mission, to try to ascertain his approach to engage with people. As I say, the illustrations change, but many of the questions are substantially the same, because they're age-old, timeless questions. There may be some newer questions that people are raising. There seems to be a stronger concern for justice today in the search for justice. But there's even a very good section in Search of God on that, actually. And so reading some of these books is also helpful. Generally, the books by David Watson, Michael Green, Schaefer, are still, John Stott, are still amongst the best that I've seen. It's very rare to find well-written evangelistic books for a university context, so I'd encourage you younger guys to write some yourselves, to contextualize answers, just as those people did 20, 30 years ago. We need fresh material every year. So the books, the tapes, the DVDs, the reviews every weekend, and maybe meeting also with a group of others who can help you. Very interesting, lastly, conversation with Martin Lloyd-Jones, the great preacher, probably the greatest preacher I've heard, actually, 30 years ago when I was a student. And I asked him at that time, do you think I should go to theological college? I was very surprised by his answer. He said, no. He said, you've studied history and political theory. You've got a good degree. You've learned to think critically and analytically. What you need now is you need someone to help your reading and to fill in the gaps. And I suggest you find somebody to meet with on a regular basis with whom you can compare what you're reading and you're listening to. And I've done that every month for the last 30 years. I still meet with the same person. He's in his 70s now. He's 20 years older than me. He was a student worker before me. And we meet for a whole morning to talk, pray, share what we're reading. We usually just sit in a car in a car park in an old Welsh castle, somewhere between where we live. And we try to stimulate each other to read different things and learn from that. What Lloyd-Jones told me was, it's one thing to be formally trained theologically, it's another to learn to think theologically. And many, this is not to say you shouldn't go into formal theological training, but many people have done that and they're not quite sure how to apply it when they leave. Actually, I found working with UCCF for 4 years among students who were always asking questions helped equip me better than subsequently studying in a theological college in France. Hmm. Because they provoked me to try to find answers to the big questions, not theoretical questions, but questions which were really existential in society.
Wow, thank you very much, Lindsay, for talking to us, and we wish you the very best in raising up a new generation of fresh evangelists for Europe.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of UCCF's Christian Persuaders podcast. For more information, go to uccf.org.uk.